I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with John Horgan. John is a science journalist and the director for the Center for Science Writings at the Stevens Institute for Technology in New Jersey. He's the author of many books about science, including The End of Science, The Undiscovered Mind, and Rational Mysticism. He's written for many publications, including Scientific American, New York Times, Time Magazine, and so forth. And he's also started a new blog called The Scientific Curmudgeon, which led to our recent connecting. He was blogging about some things of interest to me. Welcome, John.
Nice to be here.
So you have written about religion and technology. That was one of the things that really got my interest. I haven't had a chance to read your first two books, The End of Science and Undiscovered Mind. You actually wrote another one about a biography, didn't you?
I wrote, the only other book is Where Was God on 9/11, which was actually a transcript of a conversation I had with a Episcopal priest who's a friend of mine who's trying to understand 9/11 in religious terms, and I'm presenting the secular agnostic view.
Your book, Rational Mysticism, it is subtitled Dispatches from the Border Between Science and Spirituality, and in that you chronicle having gone around to many different spiritual retreats and having many spiritual experiences. And it is remarkable, I think, in the literature because you document that you have an authentic spiritual or mystical interest yourself, an interest in those the legitimacy of those kinds of experiences. But at the same time, you bring a real skeptical scientific approach to it, which not many people have been at the crossroads of those particular two places. So I just wondered if that's still an interest of yours. Is that something you're still pursuing?
It is. In fact, I've had a few blog entries lately on, for example, the attempt to bring together neuroscience and Buddhism. It turns out that right down the road from me here in, I live in Garrison, New York, which is a little hamlet on the Hudson River just north of New York City. And just down the road from me, there's a place called the Garrison Institute, which has become a center for the study of contemplative traditions. And they are bringing scientists there to talk about the results of brain scans of meditating monks and nuns and things like that. And I think there's a lot of flakiness in this field, but it's still one of the most interesting things going on in science right now. So yes, I am continuing to follow it.
I think one of the first things I read by you was an essay you published in Slate called Why I Can't Embrace Buddhism. It got emailed around by a lot of us techno-Buddhists. And can you want to recapitulate your basic argument there?
Yeah, like a lot of intellectuals, I was attracted to... Oh, first of all, I'm a lapsed Catholic. I was brought up Catholic, but gave it up in my mid-teens because I just thought it was sort of too complicated and there were too many elements of it that I thought were just superstitions. And so I started looking for some other form of spirituality that would be more consistent with a scientific outlook. And Buddhism is sort of the obvious choice, and especially Zen Buddhism, which seems to sort of strip spirituality down to its minimum. And so actually for the purposes of rational mysticism, I started taking classes in Zen, I started meditating, I started reading lots of Buddhist literature. And eventually I gave it up because I thought there are too many similarities between Buddhism and Christianity and even Catholicism. For example, the whole notion of karma seems to me to imply, even though Buddhists say that they don't believe in God or there's no God figure in Buddhism, they say that Buddhism isn't even a religion, but the concept of karma, to me, implies that there is some kind of God or mechanism in the universe that is meting out moral justice. It's this kind of supernatural force that is watching us, and you know, sort of a Santa Claus type mechanism that is determining whether we've been naughty or nice, and if we've been bad, we're reincarnated as cockroaches. If we're good, we get to be bodhisattvas, or we get to be enlightened, or something like that. And that is just too supernatural for me. I think that morality is a human invention, and to attribute it to reality apart from humans is a mistake. So that was just one thing about Buddhism that turned me off.
Reincarnation, obviously, being another aspect of that.
That's right. And you know, what a lot of Americans and Westerners who've embraced Buddhism have done is they've just gotten rid of all the aspects of Buddhism that they don't like, but they've stripped it so much of its of the belief systems that are intrinsic to Buddhism as it's practiced in the East that it's not even Buddhism anymore. I mean, if you want to meditate, that's fine, but I don't think you should call that Buddhism. And there's another part of Buddhism that I guess I don't like. It seems to me that the teachings of the Buddha boil down to trying to reduce suffering by becoming detached to an extent from the things in this life that might cause us grief if they're lost to us. So you sort of see that all things are transient, and you know, in the great scheme of things, it doesn't really matter. Things come, things go. But that, to me, and you know, Buddha epitomized this by becoming a monk. He left his wife and child and pursued this this solitary, celibate, very ascetic existence. I'm a husband and a father of two children, and the life of a celibate monk to me is not something that I can use as a model, either spiritually or morally.
I could parrot back to you the Western Buddhist answers to a lot of those things, which have to do with the fact that you find fulfillment through experience, and that you don't necessarily have to believe in reincarnation to be a good Buddhist and things like that. But in a way, I'm very sympathetic with your perspective, because my disillusionment experience was when I got to Sri Lanka, and they were in the midst of a civil war where Buddhist monks were leading pogroms, and the whole idea of a kind of Buddhism or unifying Buddhism as a to be defended eroded for me. And so I think of myself as kind of a post-Buddhist at this point. But
that's fascinating, you know, because another one of the attractions of Buddhism is supposedly that it's the most peaceful of religions, and that might be true, but it's not as though all Buddhists are pacifists. As you just pointed out, there are Buddhists in Sri Lanka who can be quite violent and aggressive. Also, I've been told that Suzuki, who was a great Zen master in Japan in the 30s and 40s, and helped introduce Zen Buddhism to the West later on, was very much a supporter of the Japanese imperialism and aggression that led to World War II. So Buddhists aren't necessarily as perfect as they're often portrayed as being.
Yeah, there's a lot of Buddhist apologetics for war and militarism throughout history, and not to mention the fact that it's became the state in Tibet. So, I totally agree with you on that. But in the sense that I'm a post-Buddhist, I'm working on a book now called Cyborg Buddha.
Uh-huh.
About
great title.
Yeah, about the impact of neurotechnology on human character and the way that we might use these things to advance patience and compassion and so on.
Yeah.
So I still go back to all these philosophic wisdom traditions, as you described. When you started your book with Houston Smith and an interview that you conducted with him and his influence on comparative religion and now in theogen research.
Yes.
I remember very vividly that my parents, when they became Unitarians, they had Houston Smith, Religions of Man, as one of their texts that we read in our family. And I think that that's probably had an enduring influence on my perspective. And then Baba Ram Dass and the whole notion that if you dropped LSD, you were getting in touch with the same mystical experience that all mystics had always had. And that's another one of the things I've given up. I'm not sure about that anymore. And that seems to be one of the things you dismiss in your book as well.
Well, I've had, you know, I think we're part of the same generation. So I grew up sort of on the tail end of the 60s when a lot of people were turning away from the religion of their parents and looking for alternatives. And so we started following some of these Eastern gurus, getting into the transcendental meditation cult, learning yoga, dropping acid and mushrooms and things like that, and search. And some of us, including me, were doing it just for fun. But we were also looking for religious experiences, for ways of knowing reality that our parents' religion, we felt, couldn't give us. And, you know, it was a very exciting time, but and one of the things that I tried to do in Rational Mysticism was to go back to some of the ideas from my youth and sift through them and try to determine what was real and what was both. But mystical, I mean, I've had what I consider to be mystical experiences, and the problem is that they can be, I think, immensely varied. So one of the problems with the perennial philosophy is that it implies that there's sort of one mystical experience that is absolutely authentic, that transcends cultures and times, and is the same for people, whatever their background. And I think that's obviously not true. They're immensely varied. And they can lead you in all sorts of down all sorts of paths of superstition, and they can give you all kinds of delusions. For me, the most important thing that I took away from mystical experiences, most of mine were from psychedelic drugs, were a sense of the strangeness and even miraculousness of existence. It was, you know, wonder is sort of the trite term, but it was wonder times 100. It was this kind of really intense form of awe just at the fact of being alive. And that's the one aspect of mystical experience that I think really is universal and for me is worth holding on to. And that also is something that is quite compatible with what science tells us, or at least what science tells me, because I think science has established that life is very strange, that we're here through an extraordinary sequence of coincidences, that the universe that we find ourselves in is strangely fine-tuned for our own existence. And there really is no explanation for that. So intellectually, science leads us to the same sense of absolute wonder and mystery that mystical experiences do.
That's very Unitarian kind of mysticism.
It is.
Yeah. I'm speaking with John Horgan. He's a science journalist and the director of the Center for Science Writings at Stevens Institute for Technology in New Jersey. He's the author of many books, including Rational Mysticism, and he blogs at Scientific Curmudgeon. Now, this interface of science and technology, one of the folks, one of the organizations that promotes the notion that examining physics and cosmology can lead to some kind of synergy between religion and science is the Templeton Foundation. And you recently wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Ed called Templeton Foundation, A Skeptic's Take. So you recapitulate that?
Well, yeah, the Templeton Foundation has more than $1 billion in assets. It was created by a guy who created the Templeton Financial Funds and became a multi-billionaire, Sir John Templeton. He's now in his 90s, and about 20 years ago, he started this foundation to try to promote reconciliation between science and religion, and he sponsored conferences and published books, and he gives out a prize every year that's worth more than $1 million to some scholar or scientist who has helped promote reconciliation between science and religion. And they just created a fellowship for journalists last year, and I applied and was accepted and was sent to Cambridge University in England to hang out with nine other journalists from really great publications in the U.S. and England. And we heard all these wonderful scientists and philosophers, theologians, including Richard Dawkins, the great atheist biologist. And while I was there, actually before I went, I was starting to have misgivings about accepting the money because the Templeton Foundation clearly sees a future for religion. It does not see science as displacing religion. It wants to come up with some kind of hybrid perspective involving parts of religion and science. And I guess actually while I was in the lead up to the fellowship and while I was there, I became more and more negative about the role of religion in world affairs. While we were over in England, the buses were bombed by Muslim terrorists, and I think about 50 people were killed. And obviously, you know, there are these religious, essentially, conflicts going on around the world. And I think that the Templeton Foundation is basically throwing so much money around that it's buying scientists and philosophers and persuading them that there is a place for religion in their views. And so, you know, I took their money, and then I bit the hand that feeds me, which I guess is something that that I'm prone to doing. And I wrote this essay for the Chronicle of Higher Education saying that I had real misgivings about having done this. It made some people at the Templeton Foundation furious, but I think I tapped into a lot of uneasiness among other people who have taken money from the Templeton Foundation or are considering taking money and are worried about the place of religion in world affairs. So I have no regrets for writing that.
I want to get back to this unity versus dissimilarities of mystical experiences, because two of the folks that you interviewed for your book, Rational Mysticism, Ken Wilber and Alexander Shulgin, I think illustrates this question. Mm. On the one hand, Shulgin says that he's taken 4,000 different psychoactive substances over the course of his research career. He does self-experimentation like that. And he describes many different kinds of mind states that these drugs can lead you to, mm-hmm. Which would suggest this kind of diversity of mental experience. And on the other hand, Ken Wilber's a kind of a modern systematizer, like many mystics before him, who tries to create a system that argues that there's one set of experiences that we're all going towards, maybe hierarchical stages that have differences among them, but there's just one mystical path.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about that divergence?
Yeah, well, Wilber is an interesting guy because he's sort of an autodidact who has trained himself in all the great mystical traditions, and he's learned every possible technique of meditation and yoga, and he's read everything under the sun, both about the spiritual traditions, and he's read a tremendous amount of science and especially psychology, and he's created this great synthetic system with zillions of moving parts and lots of really complicated diagrams. And actually, in terms of the New Age realm, and he really is a New Age figure, although I think he'd hate to be characterized that way, he's very smart. And he gets rid of a lot of the superstitious nonsense that goes along with a lot of New Age thinking. I mean, he doesn't talk down to his audience. He's pretty tough and rigorous intellectually. But when I met him, and he in one book he claims he's not just talking the talk. He claims to be enlightened himself. So he attained that goal that a lot of us were pursuing back in the 60s and 70s, the supreme mystical state of enlightenment. So obviously I was curious to meet this guy and see what he's like. And he struck me as being just another sort of neurotic, narcissistic intellectual like the rest of us.
His cult is beginning to fall apart. I don't know if you've been following that, but the followers of Ken Wilber are beginning to have schismatic splits.
that wouldn't surprise me. Well, I've heard that he's also had poor health lately, which is really too bad. But it was really just this sort of paradox of this person saying he's, you know, he meditates 3 hours every single day, and he's got this very rigorous physical regimen too, and you know, he's talking about all these sort of methods of perfecting yourself in every possible way, and as I said, I met him, and he just didn't seem like this really extraordinary person, and I think there's this paradox with Wilber also. He really thinks he has all the answers. And, you know, I talked about the mystical experiences that I've had recently. What they taught me is that any answers we come up with for how reality really works, where it came from, what it's for, are pathetically inadequate. And so there's this sense of humility that I took away from this, that, you know, our intellects just cannot get around the mystery of things. And so when I see, I think Ken Wilber has almost certainly had authentic mystical experiences, and yet in some fundamental way, I think he doesn't get it, you know, because he thinks he can figure it all out and come up with this system for kind of manufacturing ultimate knowledge. To me, I just don't buy it.
To switch topics for a sec to technology again, you saw, I'm sure, recently the oft-repeated news that there are chips being put into the brains of people with severe paralysis that allow them to control external computing and prosthetic devices. That was big in the news this week.
Front page of the New York Times just a couple of days ago.
And you wrote a review of my book,
yes,
as well as a number of other books, called Brain Chips and Other Dreams of the Cyber Evangelists,
right,
repeating not only your skepticism about the kind of moral and philosophical perspective that we're coming from, or the techno-millennial perspective, but also the feasibility of some of this. So
that's right.
Maybe you're just not reading the same news that I am, but it seems like all this stuff is coming down the pike at a pretty fast pace.
Well, you know, this is why I created my blog, The Scientific Curmudgeon, to take people behind the headlines and tell them what's going on. So science journalists and scientists themselves get very excited over some of these things. For example, in genetic engineering, we went through a period when it seemed like every week you'd hear about the discovery of a gene for high IQ, a gene for manic depression, schizophrenia, a gene for male homosexuality. And so, you know, we're getting this news that that we're totally defined by our genes, not just diseases that we're susceptible to, but these really complicated behavioral and personality traits. And it turns out that that's all spurious. Every single one of those genetic findings has not been corroborated by follow-up studies. Also, you had the field of genetic therapy, which was surrounded by tremendous hype back in the 1990s. That field has totally collapsed because there have been all these problems that arise in the clinical trials of gene therapy. So I'm sorry, Jim, but you know, people in your field continue to trot out these scenarios with superhumans who have been genetically engineered to have incredibly high IQs and perfect bodies and are going to become immortal, when the science does not exist. The science has so far has totally failed. Now, in the realm of
But there's a difference between saying that there's been hype and that it doesn't exist yet, and making the argument, which I think is the argument of end of science, which is that we've reached the limits of some kind of epistemological and technical limits in science, and that it will be impossible to actually understand the brain.
Well, actually, the end of science wasn't really about these we're talking about applied science now, and the end of science was really about the fields of science that just try to tell us how nature works and give us these really deep intellectual insights. Since The End of Science came out, though, I've been talking more about, and actually in my second book, The Undiscovered Mind, I addressed neuroscience and behavioral genetics and some of these other fields that we're trying not just to help us understand our brains and minds, but also come up with technologies for perfecting them. And so I tried to go through all these various fields, psychopharmacology, the Prozac revolution. Prozac turns out to be really no more effective than previous antidepressants, which as a class aren't more effective than plain old psychotherapy. So there is not this technological progress going on that's implied or even just stated by a lot of the transhumanist scenarios. I guess that's why I write nasty essays like that one on cyber evangelism, and with the brain chips as well. I think I just wrote my latest blog entry was about a paper in Nature just came out about a paralyzed guy who is controlling a computer with a brain chip in his head. I think this is tremendously exciting. It's really far out stuff, but there are tremendous technical problems that these people must overcome, even if they're going to devise devices that are useful for paralyzed people, let alone getting to some kind of matrix-type scenario where we really have sophisticated interfaces with machines. And I urge people, if they want to get more into some of these technical problems, to check out my website, johnhorgan.org, or go to my blog, The Scientific Curmudgeon, because I cite both my own articles and others that will give people a real sense of just what, how complicated the science is, how much needs to be done before we get to some of these transhumanist possibilities.
Well, despite the fact that you took me to task, I always beg off that I'm a social scientist and not a practicing scientist. So, but that doesn't let me off the hook for trying to be technically accurate, and I do appreciate that. I think that a lot of transhumanists, after having been in the field reading the steady stream of techno hype, begun to realize that there's a lot of repetition and a lot of vaporware that never comes to pass. So,
well, you know, essentially, when it comes to these brain chips, for them to really work, you have to decode the human brain. You have to figure out what the software of the brain is to have really effective interfaces with the brain. That, I think, this is called the neural code. That, I think, is the most important and most difficult problem that science has ever tried to solve. And people just think it's like, you know, making a Macintosh compatible with a PC, but it is not. It is phenomenally complicated, the neural code. And so I just want to see this. What I've tried to do in my writings over the last few years is give people a sense of just how difficult this problem is.
Well, John, I do appreciate what you're doing, and I look forward to your future work. I've been speaking with John Horgan. He's a science journalist, director of the Center for Science Writings at the Stevens Institute for Technology, author of many books, including Rational Mysticism, End of Science, The Undiscovered Mind. You can find him at johnhorgan.org and read his blog at The Scientific Curmudgeon. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.